Well, given how crazy the news is every day, how much is going on in the world, you may be missing some important news stories. I know I am. And so I heard about a really important news story this week that I think is one of the most important that maybe we missed. And so I want to take some time to share it with you this morning. And that is Axe Body Spray is on a mission to end the Axe Cloud, or the Axe Bomb as you may know it. Now, if you don't know what either one of those expressions are, consider yourself lucky. But if you've ever been trapped in a confined space with a bunch of dudes, you should be rejoicing right now. As the Wall Street Journal writes, teenage boys have been drenching themselves and their surroundings in Axe body spray for decades and drawing complaints and choking coughs just as long. But now even Axe is telling teenage boys to tone it down. Axe has introduced a new body spray mechanism that aims to deliver a lighter, more controlled application of spray. And they're running an ad campaign called The History of Overdoing It, which doesn't shame anyone for wearing too much product, but they make it clear that it is time to end the Axe Bomb. Now, time will tell if anything actually happens, because I was thinking about this morning. I'm not sure that you could convince teenage me to stop wearing so much Dracar Noir back in the day. But believe it or not, there is a similar scene to the Axe Cloud that happens in today's passage, which is John 12, verses 1 through 11, which you can find on page 1637 in the Bibles under your seats. Now, today's passage is actually the last passage, or is actually the first passage, technically the first passage in the book of salvation. But we're going to look at it as we wrap up our study of the book of signs, because I feel like this passage has a foot in both halves of John. The perfume cloud that we'll see in this story previews what's to come, namely the death of Jesus. But it also reveals some things about the people who are on this journey with Jesus as he is marching towards Jerusalem, where he will die for the sin of the world. So I invite you to join me reading John chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped it with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came out not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so again, like I said, this passage is technically the first passage in the book of salvation. Again, that would be part two of the Gospel of John, which really details the last week of Jesus' life on earth. But again, there's some carryover to this last sign from the book of signs. That would be where Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. It's mentioned actually three times here. Now, as you've heard me say for the last 4.5 months, because believe it, that's how long we've been in the Gospel of John, the book of signs, that is part one of the Gospel of John, details 7 signs that Jesus performed to prove that he's the Messiah, the Son of God. Again, the last sign, the raising of Lazarus from the dead, is still reverberating when the last week of Jesus' life begins in John 12. The crowd is still buzzing about it. The politicians are still plotting to kill Jesus because of it. And Jesus' friends are still celebrating it. Well, it says that Lazarus and his family decides to throw a dinner party for Jesus. And while we don't know exactly how many people are at this party, there are at least 16 people there. Because there's Jesus, there's the 12 disciples, there's Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. John says that Lazarus is sitting at the table with everyone else. Martha is busy serving everyone. And that's when Mary drops a nard bomb. Now, not to be confused with Axe, which is an overpriced deodorant. Nard is a really expensive perfume in the ancient world. Now, nard is sometimes referred to as spike nard because it comes from this spiky root of this plant that grows in the Himalayas. But despite its humble origins and its less than flattering name, nard was one of the most valued things in the ancient world. I mean, not only did it help with BO, which is not just a teenage boy problem, it's an all of us problem. This stuff actually was believed to have some medicinal properties. I mean, long story short, like, Joe Malone ain't got nothing on nard, right? Like, this was some seriously valuable stuff, which is why Mary's application of so much of this stuff causes a scene. John says that Mary pours a pint of this stuff out on Jesus' feet. And when she does, Judas Iscariot, who John hasn't mentioned in the gospel until now, speaks up. Judas, who John tells us will later betray Jesus, is outraged by this. But he doesn't just tell Mary to tone it down like Axe is with teenage boys. He says, hey, look, why wasn't this sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. See what I mean about nard being some expensive stuff? A year's wages. But of course, while Judas does have a valid point, his objection to Mary's actions aren't so noble. I mean, John tells us explicitly that he didn't say this because he cared about the poor. He says this because he had a habit of helping himself to all the money that he was tasked with watching over. And just like that, we get a preview of what's to come. I mean, we get this glimpse of this betrayal that Jesus will face from one of his own. Same time, we get this preview of the burial that awaits Jesus. I mean, that's what Jesus says in verse 7. Mary is preparing him for his burial. Now, I don't think Mary is necessarily trying to cause a scene here. I'm not even sure that maybe she fully understands this prophetic thing that she's doing. I think she honestly just, you know, genuinely is grateful to Jesus, right? He brought her brother back from the dead. I also think she, like, genuinely loves Jesus. And, you know, acts of devotion, acts of love, they don't really need explanation, do they? I mean, you probably don't question your kids giving you a gift or your parents giving you a gift. You understand it's an act of love. You probably don't question a friend who does something meaningful or thoughtful on your behalf. You probably don't ask your spouse, why are we going out to our dinner on our anniversary? Like, what's your angle here, right? You don't typically need explanation for acts of love, including costly acts of love. Now, that said, we might question the expense of some costly acts of love if we're sharing a bank account. That's why every Christmas when we start seeing these ads for, like, Lexus, you know, with a bow wrapped in the front, I'm like, this is the most ridiculous thing ever. Because it would be really fun to find one of these parked in your driveway on Christmas morning. It would be not so fun to be getting the monthly payments on this for the next several years, right? But of course, outside of, you know, pretty ridiculous ad campaigns, beyond that, I think we can understand that you can't really put a price on love. And acts of devotion, including those that cost something, we don't need to question the acts of it. We understand what's intended to be communicated. We understand that love is being communicated when something is given to us. And this is how Jesus receives Mary's actions. He doesn't question her intentions. He simply receives it. But he also shares something that may be a bit surprising. What I mean is, he may be suggesting that Mary is the only one, other than him, who understands what's happening. I mean, at least that's the way I read this story. Because did you notice that Mary doesn't say, "Whoa, Jesus, what are you talking about when he says that she's preparing me for my burial?" Which suggests that she has some sense of what's ahead. Now, she may not understand everything that's about to happen, but she seems to know that something is up. Now, how Mary knows this, we don't know. John doesn't tell us. Jesus just says pretty explicitly that she is preparing him for his final act. Now, of course, the thing about Jesus is he actually has been trying to tell everyone what's going on. He talks about what's ahead quite frequently, and sometimes he gets very explicit. For example, in Mark 10, Mark 10 says this, "Again, Jesus took the 12 aside and he told them what was going to happen to him. 'We are going to go up to Jerusalem,' he said, 'and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise.'" Jesus says that on a number of occasions, but no one seems to hear him. At least, none of the 12 disciples seem to hear him. Mary seems to have a sense that something is going on. How does she know? Well, maybe by regularly being in the place where we find her right now, at the feet of Jesus. This is now the third time that this is stated in the Gospels, which seems to suggest that maybe this was a place where Mary spent a lot of time, which maybe suggests to us that if you and I don't understand spiritual things, if you and I struggle to know God's will, could it be because we have yet to spend enough time at the feet of Jesus? Now, so you know, that expression, sitting at someone's feet, is actually a Hebrew idiom. It's a way of speaking of sitting under the teaching of someone, which means even though you and I can't literally sit at the feet of Jesus like Mary did, we can still learn from Jesus. We can still sit with him and learn from him. At the same time, we can also learn some things about this expression of love that Mary shares. I mean, she gives him her very best. She pours everything out, I mean, quite literally. And I say that because this jar of nard is probably the most valuable thing that she owns. Again, it's a year's worth of wages. So are you someone who is like Mary, or are you someone who's more like the Judases of the world, who maybe criticizes those who seem to be generous in their love? I mean, don't get me wrong, right? Judas is right. A lot could be done with this kind of money. But he seems to miss the point of this whole situation. And he seems to miss the point that love is about more than money. Like, life is about more than money. And in God's economy, no gift that is given to God's purposes is wasted. Now, the thing is Mary gives her most valuable possession. I'm assuming that your most valuable possession and my most valuable possession is probably different. I mean, maybe you're into the eau de toilette like she is, but chances are your most valuable thing is not a little bottle of something. It could be, I don't know, a comfortable home or a successful life or a successful self-image. It could be family, fortune, or fame, or a million other things. But the question remains, like, could you or would you give it up for Jesus? Now, I'm not saying that we should all sell everything that we own and give the money to the poor. Jesus does say that, but he says it to one person. He specifically says it to one person. You'll find it in Mark chapter 10. I don't think he calls us all to do that, but I do think he calls us all to be willing to give up everything for him. I think he actually calls us to be willing to use everything for his purposes. So is there a way that you could use whatever God has blessed you with to serve Jesus, to show your love for him by serving others? Now, when a question gets like that gets asked, sometimes there are objections like, well, but I work so hard, shouldn't I be able to enjoy these things? Or it feels like a waste that I would, you know, spend my life doing these things and just to give it away. And that's a fair way of looking at things, but it's also, I think, the way that the world looks at it. And I think it misses the point of beautiful acts of love and devotion. It misses the point that life is about more than money and possessions. And that, you know what? We should never question the acts of generosity and lavish love when they are used for the things of God. At the same time, we should not question gifts and the size of gifts. For example, saying, well, that person gave a lot more because, you know, they have more money. Or that person gave a lot more because they gave, you know, some actual money. This person only gives time. But one of the things that Jesus reminds us is it's not so much a matter of the quantity of a gift, but actually the posture of the heart. In fact, Jesus explicitly says in the Gospel of Luke, when people are watching people drop money in the offering plate, Jesus says that a poor person who drops a couple of pennies in gives more than everybody else. Jesus says this poor widow was put in more than all the others because all these other people gave their gifts out of their wealth, out of their abundance. But she gave out of her poverty to put in all that she had to live on. And of course, speaking of poverty, I feel like we should make something clear about John's gospel, and specifically verse 8, because Jesus says something that sometimes gets misinterpreted by Christians like us. Jesus says that you will always have the poor among you. Some people take that verse as a license to say, well, if that's the case, maybe we don't have to take care of the poor. I have heard people literally say things like, Jesus says, look, we're always going to have the poor. We're not going to fix the problem, so why even try? I don't need to give to people. I don't need to support a charity, and I certainly don't want my taxes going to people like that. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but like, I don't think Jesus is giving us a pass on caring for the poor. Especially since in Matthew's gospel, Jesus literally says that caring for the poor is one of the ways that we actually show that we are his disciples. You can check out that parable. Now, what Jesus is actually saying here is you're going to have plenty of opportunities to take care of the poor because the poor are going to be with you until I return to make all things right in the end. But in the short time that I'm with you now, here on earth, and in this specific moment where I'm being anointed for the work that is ahead of me, that is dying for your sin and the sin of the world, it's okay to love lavishly. It's okay to waste a little perfume. In other words, don't miss the magic of this moment. And of course, what I love about this story is not only does Mary pour out a whole lot of expensive perfume onto Jesus' feet, but she actually begins to rub it in with her hair, which means that nard cloud is about to go with her everywhere she goes. Now, that may be one of the reasons why the room fills with the fullness of this fragrance, but I think it may also be this indicator that, you know what? The people who are present for this are going to get reminders of this moment for the next several days, because the scent of this moment is going to go with her everywhere she goes. So don't underestimate what God can do with the smallest of gifts, with the greatest of gifts, even with gifts that seem like they're wasted. Now, here's the thing. If the story were to end right there, we might go home feeling pretty happy about things, even if maybe we're still wrestling with that question of what would I be willing to give up for God? But of course, the story doesn't end there. Verse 9 says that people hear that Jesus is back in town. They hear that he's at Lazarus' house, and so everyone goes there to see Jesus and to see Lazarus. Well, verse 10 says, so the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. Last week in John 11, the chief priests just agreed that it'd be better for one person to die for the whole nation. But now it's two people that have to die. What's going on here? Well, first of all, acts of evil spill over like acts of love. At the same time, I think we're getting a preview of what's to come. And that is that those of us who choose to follow Jesus, we actually sign up to walk a similar road to that of Jesus. Jesus says time and time again in the Gospels that we are called to die to ourselves, and that some of us may actually die like him. Now, of course, the thing about Lazarus is we don't know what happens to him from this point on. This is actually the last time he's seen in the Gospels. And that could be because he went into hiding after this. It could also be that he went to the grave again. But of course, whether he dies of natural causes or at the hands of wicked men, Lazarus eventually died again. But of course, it isn't the end of the story, is it? In fact, we just heard in John 11, when Lazarus died the first time, Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die." Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Well, if so, then you're called to give up everything for God. Like, we are all called to give up our lives for God's purposes. And I don't think that means that we're all to seek martyrdom any more than we're all to sell everything that we own. But this is the call of the gospel. That we truly would die to ourselves. That we would give our whole selves to the one who gave himself up for us. And in doing so, that we might actually receive life in the kingdom of God. As Jim Elliot said, "He is no fool who gives away what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Now, for the record, Jim Elliot actually heard that from someone else, but Jim Elliot wrote those words in his journal while he was serving in Ecuador, where he was a part of a team that was trying to reach a group called the Alcas, a tribe that was an unreached people group that had no contact with the outside world. Jim Elliot spent time with a team trying to reach that group. But shortly after penning those words in his journal, Jim Elliot was killed by the people that he sought to serve. He was speared to death along with four others. And the lives of these five men came to a tragic end. And maybe you know this story. But the thing is their death isn't the end of the story. And in fact, the end of the story tells us that their lives were not wasted at all. That's because not only do I think these men are experiencing life with Jesus in his kingdom, but two of the widows of these men actually continued the work in Ecuador. Elizabeth Elliot, Jim's wife, and a woman named Rachel Saint returned to Ecuador, where they continued the work of trying to reach the Alca people, where they actually began to make inroads, and they actually developed some friendships. I think most importantly, they actually introduced some Alca people to the person of Jesus. Now, it took a lot of time, and a lot of money, and a lot of prayer, a lot of sacrifice, and it took an incredible act of forgiveness. Because Elizabeth Elliot and Rachel Saint forgave and befriended the men who killed their husbands. But that led to many Alcas trusting in Jesus and finding life in his name. Now, full disclosure, Elizabeth Elliot is no saint. For the record, neither is Rachel Saint. What I mean is, they have flaws, and you can read about them online. People like to talk about them. You will also find people who raise some pretty valid questions about some of the flaws that sometimes comes with missionary work. But man, it doesn't invalidate the work that God did among the Alca people. It doesn't invalidate the sacrifice that five families made in seeking to share the good news of the one who is the resurrection and the life. He is no fool who gives away what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Jesus couldn't have said it better himself. I mean, he could have, but you know what I mean, right? This is the call of the gospel. Might we heed this call, that we would follow God's example as dearly loved children and walk in the way of Jesus, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. And in following the example of Jesus, may God be pleased to work through us and in us, so that we might declare with the saints, "Thanks be to God, who in Christ always leads us in triumphal procession, and through us spreads the fragrance of the knowledge of him everywhere." Amen.